Welcome to Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind. Alaska is among the fastest warming regions on Earth. Recent studies show the rate of Arctic-wide warming is almost four times faster over the past four decades than anywhere else on the planet. And this dramatic shift in the permafrost, the rising seas, and other impacts is forcing native communities there to confront a stark reality, fight for their survival, or in some cases, face the painful prospect of relocation. And that struggle is at the heart of a new documentary from Frontline and the Howard Center for Investigative Journalism at Arizona State University called Alaska's Vanishing Native Villages. It shows how indigenous Alaskan communities are working to preserve their cultures and traditional ways of life, ways that are deeply connected to the land and the sea, but facing this threat from climate change. To discuss this important and very timely documentary, we're joined by Patty Talahongva, a veteran journalist and storyteller who has long covered news in Indian country. Her work has appeared in Indian Country Today, Native America Calling, National Native News, and other outlets. And she's also the director and producer of Alaska's Vanishing Native Villages. Patty, thank you so much for joining us.
Ethan, thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on, and I want to let listeners know as we talk about this film that you can watch it. Alaska's Vanishing Native Villages is available at pbs.org/frontline. You can also find it in the PBS app and on Frontline's YouTube channel, and it's also available on the PBS Documentaries Prime Video channel. So, Patty, first of all, congratulations on the film. Thank you so much for making it. And in recent years, we've seen more coverage of how the climate crisis is forcing Native communities to make these tough choices of relocating to higher grounds or away from the shoreline. But it's not getting as much attention as I think it really needs, as they, in many ways, these villages are the canary in the coal mine for climate impacts, at least here in the United States. So I just wanted to ask you, what inspired you to make this documentary?
Well, thank you, Ethan. And exactly what you said, it's not getting enough coverage. There are really, really tough situations that the villages are facing. And so I've been covering this crisis, you know, global warming and the impact on Native villages for a long time. And I had an interview, a radio interview with some elders who told me they have the right to be cold. And that really resonated with me, that, you know, we all have the right to our life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, right? And in, for their cultures, especially in the Arctic and along the Bering Sea coast, they rely on the cold. They rely on the ice. They rely on that kind of environment. And their cultures, their languages, their religions are all tied to that. So this was a really good opportunity to be able to go out to these remote villages and really show what the situation is, what they're facing, and how they're dealing with it. So we know that there are more than 100 Alaska Native villages that are facing such extreme situations that their coastlines are eroding, storms are coming in and damaging their homes and their other infrastructure there. And so they are looking at either protecting in place, you know, or, you know, looking at starting the whole process of relocation, which is a really tragic history when it comes to Indian country.
Absolutely. I know you talk from your own personal experience a bit in the film. I know that you're a member of the Hopi Nation in Arizona, and just curious how your background, your identity as a Hopi impacted how you viewed the story and how you covered it.
Well, yes, because we have the shared history of the different government policies that have been enacted on not just Native Americans, but Alaska Natives as well. And so for the village of Hooper Bay, they have people from the Native village of Paiute who were forced to move to Hooper Bay because the government came in and built a school in Hooper Bay and said, you have to move here. That's such the story across Indian country. Our forced relocation, our forced education, and at what cost? At what cost to the cultures, the language, the religions? So this all of this history resonated with me. And just seeing the people there too, there were so many similarities to my own village at First Mesa. And I had to kind of laugh because, you know, the people looked like us. We looked like them.
So you headed for an area in Alaska called the YK Delta, about 500 miles west of Anchorage. It's home to dozens of small native villages, and you traveled to three of them. Can you talk more about why you decided to go to those areas specifically within Alaska?
Well, it's all about access. So you can't go into these small villages unless you have a guide, someone to help you navigate once you get there, because most of them don't have hotels and they don't have restaurants. So when you bring a crew in, you've got to be able to house them and feed them and then get around. There are no, in the villages that we went to, Chivac and Hooper Bay, they had maybe, I don't know, a handful of cars. Otherwise, people get around on snow machines in the wintertime when, you know, that's when we were there. Or in the summertime, they have ATVs. I guess the brand they use is Honda, so they call them Hondas. And but no cars, and you can't really rent a car. There's no Lyft, there's no Uber. I mean, so you really need a guide in the villages. And we were very fortunate through a series of conversations with personal friends who gave me connections to Marie Achema, who runs Sea Stories in Anchorage, out of Anchorage. And she was the one who introduced us to our guide in Chivac, and that was Earl Atchak, who was just wonderful. And he's a part of the search and rescue team out there, so we really felt comfortable being with him, knowing that even though we were traveling on snow machine from Hooper Bay or from Chivac to Hooper Bay and back in whiteout conditions, we felt safe being with them because they would not put themselves in a situation where we'd all end up having to be rescued. But I'm telling you, there's nothing like being on a snow machine, driving to Hooper Bay right on the coast of the Bering Sea, and you can't see anything around you, and snow is falling on you, and it's freezing cold. Huh. But the people there are telling me it's not as cold as it used to be.
Interesting. We're speaking with Patty Talahongva, who is the director and producer of the Frontline documentary, Alaska's Vanishing Native Villages, here on Your Calls One Planet series. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Patty, can you describe a bit about these villages? Describe these villages to us. And I love that comment you made, or you recollected from one of your interviewees, that they have the right to be cold. Can you talk about the lifestyle up there, and particularly for these native villages, how they're still maintaining a lot of their subsistence living? Can you describe what that is like culturally and just the setting?
Absolutely, because I think it's really fascinating when you compare what a family does in Chivac or Hooper Bay, or even in Kotzebue, which is above the Arctic Circle, and then what families do in the lower 48, you know, whether it's in Arizona, California, I mean, whatever state you want to name outside of Alaska. Up there, it's the entire family that goes out to harvest from the ocean or from the land so that they can eat. And, you know, what family all cooperates when it comes to getting groceries, you know, or even planting a garden. Up there in those communities, they know their seasons, they know the animals, they know when it's the right time to go out and harvest a seal or to go fish for salmon or any other number of different variety of fish that they eat, or if they're going to plan a walrus hunt or a whale hunt. So it's everyone. In the film, you see the entire boatload of family members, from babies to elders, who are all going off to berry camp, and they're going to fill their buckets with berries that's going to last them for the next year until the next berry season comes around and they can pick a fresh crop. But nowhere else, you know, people, we don't plan like that. We don't say, okay, we're going to go out and get food and that food's going to last us for more than a week or 2 weeks. They always have to plan, and that's their traditional way. And so they grow up. That's their culture. That's what they do. And nobody is saying, well, I don't think I want to go out and harvest today. If they don't harvest, then they're in trouble because they need to go get food. And there are stores up there, but I love the scene in the film with the kids who talked about how much they value their traditional diets. And they know and understand that food in the stores up there are not good for them. And they even said, you know, the stores are full of junk. Scenes that were not put into the film, the students told me that if we eat that food in the stores, we'll get fat or our teeth will fall out. So it was a very different conversation with the students, you know, the young teenagers at the school there and their perspective on climate change and what the differences that they're seeing and how much they want to continue their way of life.
We have some wonderful scenes. First of all, you sampling one of the berries, and it looked to me like it tasted delicious. And another great scene of a man ice fishing and just eating a small fish just raw right out of the sea. Pretty remarkable shots of just how central food is to the culture. And as you say, it's really a village effort to get that food. But let's talk about climate change and what it's doing to these villages. And there's the remnants in these villages of a major typhoon that hit in 2022 that really created a lot of damage. Can you talk about that typhoon and just the impacts that you saw firsthand?
Well, in the three villages we went to, we could see debris. And when we were there in the wintertime, the debris was covered with snow. But Earl was pointing out all of those formations in the snow. He said all of that's debris that was washed in from Typhoon Merbak. And they're just going to leave it because that's way too much effort to try to remove it. And also, some of it was in the river, which is by Chivac. So we saw that there. And then we went to Hooper Bay, and the students were telling me how the water came in, like, I want to say around 20 miles inland, because they're at sea level. And those dunes that used to protect Hooper Bay, most of them were washed away. When that water receded, it took out the dunes. But during the height of the storm, Hooper Bay turned into a series of three islands. And that was so stressful because nobody could cross the water to go check on family members. So, and that you've got the old village separated from the new village. And then the area where the store is located, the store is up on a little hill, the old village is on a different hill. And then you've got the new village where the school is located. And it was very, very tough for them to get out and go around because of all the water that was there. And then in Kotzebue, well, that was another situation up there, because Kotzebue, they built that seawall to protect the village there, and it's a hub, so there's a lot of activity. There are hotels there, there are restaurants there, lots of cars in that are, you know, in Kotzebue. But one thing that happened when Merbak hit, their road to the airport flooded, so that was a concern, because the seawall that they built to protect the village is about half a mile long, and it doesn't extend further south to protect the airport road and runway. So that was impacted. So everyone up and down the coast there, they were telling us how awful it was during Merbak and how they're still trying to recover. Homes that were damaged still have not been fully repaired because of lack of funding or delayed funding, all the reports they have to file, the follow-up. And if you get one part, you know, maybe misinformation or, you know, just filling out grant forms, your request gets denied and you have to start the process all over again. So that's very frustrating. Mm-hmm. And that was a part of the film that we mentioned, that there's so many federal regulations and red tape that they have to overcome to get funding. And now with all the cuts, they're looking at, I'm not even sure what's going to happen now.
and so dependent on federal support. Let's talk about that. But first, I just want to let listeners know that this is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're speaking with Patty Talahongva, a veteran journalist and storyteller who has long covered news in Indian country. And she's the director and producer of the film we're talking about. It's airing on Frontline on PBS, Alaska's Vanishing Native Villages. And I want to open up the phone lines now. If you have been to Alaska and you have questions for Patty or observations that you want to share with the rest of our listeners, or if you just have questions for Patty about how these villages are doing and how she was able to put this film together, the number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org if you have questions. And Patty, a lot for us to talk about in terms of the federal policies, and I want to get to that in a second. But just to stay on this topic of the impacts are facing this, you know, we talked about the typhoon that created some major challenges for the village. And you've also interviewed experts, including Tom Ravens, a civil engineer who's an expert on the Arctic coast, who talked about what global warming is doing to the permafrost, which is a natural way to protect against coastal erosion. And so losing that glue, as it was described in your film, is so critical. Can you talk about the permafrost and other impacts from a warming climate that are affecting these Alaskan native villages?
Yes, the permafrost. And for people who you know, may not understand what's permafrost, literally when you dig into the ground, we had heard from an elder who said when he was a young boy, he could dig down like 8 inches. And as you clear away whatever tundra that you're digging through, when you hit the permafrost, it's like hitting a block of ice. It looks like ice. It's ice, you know? So when you pull back the tundra, that's the ice. That's the permafrost. Today, that elder says he has to dig almost to his waist before he hits ice. That's how much thawing has occurred in his lifetime. So that's what is happening. And the impact is not just on the coastline, it's on their travel. So because the permafrost is thawing, the temperatures are warming up. That means the ice is not forming like it did in the past. And that creates problems when they travel in the wintertime, especially because they're expecting that all of those little puddles of water that are all over the tundra are frozen and they can just drive right over them. But if they're not frozen, then there's the danger of falling through, or a river that they typically cross in the wintertime when it's supposed to be frozen, or sea ice that's supposed to have formed along the coast that will help act as a buffer when the waves come in from a storm and kind of give a break on the waves so they don't just come right on land. So those are some of the issues that they're facing now, that the climate is warming, the land is warming. They even have, I don't remember the name of these contraptions, but basically they're cylinder-shaped poles that are put into the ground. We saw this outside of our hotel when we stayed in Kotzebue. And they're basically air conditioners / freezers that are pumping cold air into the ground to keep the permafrost cold. Because that, again, if the ground is starting to thaw, that permafrost is thawing, that destabilizes the entire structure. So they're literally trying to refreeze the ground with these contraptions.
And they're also talking about relocating, and are in fact relocating, some of these villages, and in the process of that, can you talk about what that involves?
Well, it is quite the process. And we talked with Neil, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his last name. He is with the Alaska Tribal Health Consortium. And I know I got that name wrong too, but he was talking to us about the steps. And there are more than 80 steps to relocation. So the first step is you've got to identify land. And one thing I think people in the lower 48 may not be aware of, but the interior of Alaska is all tundra and there's huge swampy areas. So the land is not solid. And to try to come in and fill in all of these little swampy land areas there, that would be cost prohibitive. So they've got to find pockets of land and then find out who owns that land, what jurisdiction is it in under, and then work with that federal agency, if it is a federal agency or a state agency, to identify a place large enough to move the village to. But within that first step, there are a number of other steps they have to take in order to identify and then get that land. So it's a huge process. Think about just building any community. So they don't need so much, you know, roads, but they do need houses. They need a school. They need some kind of health system, healthcare facility, and a store, some kind of police area. They need an airport. Depending on where they're located, they may need some kind of dock to access the waterway. All of that is just, you have to go after so many different federal grants, state grants, tribal funds to make all of this come together. So when I started reporting on this issue, Newtok was the one village that had been identified as like, they have got to move. And this was more than 20 years ago. So Newtok has spent all of this time trying to figure out how to move, get that process started. And last year, they finally moved the last one of their citizens or the residents into the new village, and it's called Muktavik. So now the people have all moved, but the houses are still temporary homes. Not everyone has a permanent house yet. And then on top of that, the federal government has to go back in and they have to decommission the old village of Newtok, take everything man-made out, and restore the land to its pristine state, and then return it back to another federal agency. And who knows how long that's going to take, because, again, it took more than 20 years just to move the village and the people to the new site of Muktavik.
Such an intense, just financial, logistical process, as you described, and also an emotional one, as I noted that one person in the film talked about, some people just not wanting to leave. This is their old village, even if it's at risk, they're going to stay as long as they can. But as you've talked so much about the federal government's role in this, in terms of the difficulty of applying for funds, but the need for federal support to do the relocation, to build the seawalls, the other things that are needed to fortify these very vulnerable villages. So what's happening now with the Trump administration? Because you touch on this very briefly in the documentary, but wanted to find out from you the latest there on how federal policies, federal cutbacks might be affecting these villages now.
We did hear from one of the leaders that we interviewed about some grants money that they had thought they were going to receive, and now they're not getting it. And across the board, we're no longer a part of the Paris Accord. So that's a big thing. Cuts to FEMA have definitely impacted the villages, and concern about this winter coming up that they're not going to have money to help mitigate any kind of storms that may come in. And so FEMA cuts, and not only that, NOAA cuts. So cuts to any kind of weather forecasting system, which the villages totally rely on because of the planes that come in, and of course their navigation on the water as well. So there are a lot of concerns about what's going to happen now, what kind of grant money is available, if they're going to get any kind of grant money. So a lot is up in the air, and it seems like every day there's a new headline with what's going to happen, proposed cuts, and how it's going to impact the villages. I just saw another posting from the village of Hooper Bay, and they are being told they cannot fish for a certain kind of salmon right now. And they're saying, but this this run of salmon doesn't affect our area. So there, I mean, it's a challenge. It seems like everywhere they look, whether it's moving or whether it's their food or just safety and security.
Yeah, it's a lot in flux, and it very much ties into our next segment. We're going to talk about cutbacks to NOAA, which does a lot of that science that underpins our weather predictions. So in a way, it's a good preview for our next segment, and we're just about out of time, Patty, but I wanted to just close by asking you just briefly, what are you working on next? Are you going to be focusing on these villages again in Alaska, or do you have other projects in the works?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, that would be wonderful to be able to continue to follow up with what's happening there, and to see, you know, even in 6 months, where are the people in Hooper Bay, Chivac, and Kotzebue? So that's to be seen, and we'll have to just see how that turns out. Of course, Frontline was wonderful to work with, and a great opportunity to get out there and tell a story, especially because so many reporters who are in Alaska, even they have a hard time getting out to these remote villages because of the cost and because of the conditions, and, you know, newsrooms everywhere have cutbacks. So it was really important to be able to get out there and show the areas and the people and to tell their story.
Well, I hope you get a chance to do that sequel. The film is called Alaska's Vanishing Native Villages. It's available on Frontline. You can watch it at pbs.org/frontline in the PBS app, on Frontline's YouTube channel, also available on the PBS Documentaries Prime Video channel. Patty Talahongva, veteran journalist, storyteller, and director and producer of Alaska's Vanishing Native Villages, thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls One Planet series.
It's Esquili, Ethan. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Coming up next, we're going to talk about proposed cutbacks to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and what that means for climate science, weather forecasts, and more. We'll be joined by the former chief scientist from that agency. So stay with us. We'll be back just after this short break.